And we were able to scale from length to length very, very quickly. To give you a sense of how quickly we started our agency in 2008 with no money, our seed capital was $1,000, which was the equivalent of 64,000 rupees back in the day. And on a seed capital of 64,000 rupees, we were a 300 member agency in 5 years. Completely organically on the back of working with clients, like I said, Axe, L'Oreal, Pepsi, really colorful client list because of the opportunity that we got. And we grew organically from a 4-member team with 64,000 rupees to 300 member team with millions of dollars in revenue every year. And that was all organic over a period of 5 years. So the big boys said, look, we're obviously doing something wrong. The fact that these kids are getting it right and we're getting it wrong obviously means, you know, there's something wrong in our approach.
Hello and welcome to the Founder Journey segment of the Indian Dream Podcast. Today, we have Suveer Bajaj, co-founder of Foxy Moron. Foxy Moron is one of India's best digital media and advertising agency that Suveer started when he was just 19. Foxy Moron started with a seed capital of rupees 60,000, and 13 years later, the business does more than 100 crores in annual turnover profitably without any external investment. Foxy Moron's journey is a classic example of starting something in a new and emerging market and then growing the business as the market grows. Suveer and his co-founder started Foxy Moron in 2008 and specifically focused on what could have been called a niche back then, digital marketing. Social media, smartphones, video consumptions didn't really start taking off till 2010s, but because they were the only few agencies that was focused on this niche, they were able to work with clients like Cadbury, L'Oreal, Force India Racing very early on in their journey. Over the next few years, they kept delivering fantastic work and expanding the client roster to build a large profitable business. Building an agency business is hard but also rewarding if done right. Somewhere in 2015, Foxy Moron had a term sheet for an acquisition by one of the largest advertising networks in the world. This would turn out to be an inflection point in their journey, but before I talk more about how the journey unfolded post that term sheet, it's important to understand how the advertising business operates globally. There are 6 advertising networks that dominate this market globally, namely WPP, Publicis, Omnicom, Interpublic, Havas, and Dentsu. You would have heard of some of these names. These networks are nothing but holding companies which have a bunch of subsidiaries that they've either built or acquired to cater to the various verticals under the large umbrella of advertising. For example, WPP owns the advertising agency Ogilvy, a PR agency called BCW, a media investment management agency called Group M. You get the idea. These 6 have revenues in billions of dollars, and through the subsidiaries under them, they work with the largest companies in the world. One of these networks had given Foxy Moron a term sheet for an acquisition. In the process of evaluating the term sheet, Suveer and his co-founders decided not to get acquired and instead operate independently. And that one decision also gave birth to Zoo Media. The profits from Foxy Moron have been reinvested to build a new age network consisting of 7 agencies that have been built in-house or acquired, operating under the intersection of content, media, data, and tech. Together, Zoo Media has over 100 crores in revenue and has been profitable for years. Suveer and the team at Zoo Media are now on the path to building a global digital business, and we can't be more excited for them. Listen to the episode to understand how the journey unfolded from the early days in 2008, how they scaled the business, Suveer's perspective on hiring and culture. We also talk about Zoo Media and the long-term plans that the team has to build a global digital business out of India. This is a fascinating conversation with one of the more articulate founders we've spoken to. You don't want to miss this one. Suveer, thank you so much for joining us today. Very excited to have this conversation about Zoo Media, Foxy Moron, and all the other, you know, digital marketing businesses that you're building right now. Let's start at 2008. This is 2008, you're 19, and you decide, this is before digital marketing was a thing, right? This is social media hadn't really kicked off. What was the thesis? You guys started Foxy Moron back then. What was the thesis?
So thanks, Sid and Sahil, for having me on the show. I really appreciate the opportunity to be chatting with you guys. You're right. 2008 actually was when we kickstarted our first agency, Foxy Moron. I was in the second year of college at the time. I went to a college called HR College in Bombay. I studied a program called BMS. And in this college, in this program, we were encouraged to take on internships after we finished the summer of the semester that broke into the summer. And I did a couple of internships. I started interning straight after school, actually, straight after my 10th grade. And I interned right from banking banking to HR to media, etc. And I would be flattering the idea of internships if I said I learned anything back then. So we decided to not do, I decided to not do an internship. And I remember I was sitting at home twiddling my thumbs, wondering what to do that summer. So we were sitting on Sunday afternoon at my house with a couple of my friends, and we were just chatting. I said, hey, look, I'm not doing an internship this summer. What are you guys doing? And someone said, oh, look, I'm working on a friend's project. I'm branding, a school. I said, oh, you know, my friend has given me this opportunity to work with her dad and, you know, brand a not-for-profit library. And can you help me? Can you help me? And we said, okay, cool. You know, if we're working together, then, you know, why don't we just, pool whatever money we make and we'll split it three ways. And then the Sindhi in me, you know, got me to draft a contract. And I said, let's make this official, made a partnership deed and blah, blah, blah. Also come from a family of lawyers. So that made it, you know, that made the narrative so much more convincing. And I drafted a deed. And on the 23rd of March, we picked this name, Foxymoron. And on the 10th of May that year, we signed this partnership deed and the firm was born. So that's the story of how we actually kickstarted.
And what was the idea back then? Was it just to pick up whatever projects come along your way in terms of marketing, branding? What was the thesis? Was there any thesis, or was just, you know, college students trying to find an internship, have created a partnership, and let's see where this goes?
Well, we knew we wanted to fit inside the domain of advertising and marketing. We didn't know what, to be honest. We didn't know what advertising and marketing entailed because, like I said, our experience was only a couple of internships old. Also, marketing is a specialization you get to pick in your third year in BMS. And we were in between the second and third year. So it's not like we had even studied marketing before. But we just believed that, you know, inherently we were creative individuals and we needed an outlet for expression, but a professional outlet for expression, not a personal outlet for expression like what my music would give me, for instance. So we knew we would function in the wheelhouse of advertising and marketing. We just didn't know what. So in the early days, we just said yes to everything. We took whatever work that came our way, whether it was print or whether it was outdoor, whether it was merchandising, whether it was events, whether it was brand films. We just said yes to everything. And about a year and a half later, at the end of 2009, is when we committed saying, let's do some work on digital. Multiple reasons for that. One is because we came with no legacy of television or print, which is where most people in media start their, or in advertising start their career. So it's not like we had any baggage as well with television and print. B, we were really young, so we were digitally native. We were the first generation to have a cell phone in our pocket at 19. We were the first generation to, you know, have desktops in our faces from the time we were 8 and 9 years old, as opposed to our parents who were already in the workforce by then. You know, and we explored, these technologies from the perspective of being consumers and being whatever, right? Before we, you know, started adopting them in our professional lives. And these gave us, like you said, there was no concept of digital marketing as an industry. So there was no catch up that we needed to do. There was no cementing of our position in the industry that we needed to do. But hell, we had a far bigger challenge. We had to create a category, right? And that was a challenge by itself. So later in 2009, we said, look, there's no point. We do everything and you throw spaghetti on the wall and you see what sticks. Let's pick one thing. Let's do it really right. If we get it right, great. We're hitting a home run. If we don't get it right, we're 19. What the hell do we have to lose, right?
And so you picked up digital, right? What I want to understand is 2009, 10, smartphones hadn't come up. Social media hadn't really kicked off. What was the concept of digital marketing back then?
So in 2008-9, the idea of digital marketing was limited to website banao, CRM campaign karo, or maybe, you know, a little bit of search ads. Google search was still a thing back then. But the idea of digital was limited to just these three things. Like you said, smartphone, social media, video, no real concept of. But by 2010, social media was something that we used as consumers, right? Our generation got onto Facebook in 2006. So we were familiar with the platform as consumers, and therefore we identified the opportunities to commercialize them and market them. If you guys remember back in 2005 and 2006, when we got onto Facebook, there was no concept of Facebook pages. There were only Facebook groups. Facebook was built as a community platform. It was not built as a marketable commercial platform. And the organic hacks that we had to figure out to market on Facebook were at that time revolutionary and definitely game-changing. Today, of course, it's a, you know, thoroughbred commercial platform for brands to engage with audiences on. So the first, I would say, maybe year and a half of our digital journey was actually spent doing two things. One, trying to figure out the what question, trying to answer the question saying, when we go to a client and pitch to them, what are we going to pitch? Because fine, you know, digital is a word that is going to become a buzzword very soon, and people are going to ask for digital solutions. And when you say that you're a digital solutions provider, what does that mean? What are you going to do for them? How are you going to help their business? How are you going to do for their brand? And that was a very big question for us to answer, because no one knew the answer. So it's not like we could open a textbook and find the answer, or we could go to an existing advertising agency and find the answer. The closest best reference we had was what the West was doing, because the West has been maybe 18, 24 months ahead of the curve as far as India's adoption on digital marketing, advertising, media, entertainment is concerned. Simultaneously, what we also needed to do is we needed to do a lot of education, right? So when you go to a client and you say, look, this is the services that I have in my wheelhouse, this is how they benefit your brand. And that cycle involved a ton of education as to why what we do could potentially help them and why they should spend a percentage of their marketing dollar with guys like us on digital. And there were only 8 or 9 guys like us at that point of time who they could have spent their money with. So the first maybe 1.5 or 2 years was invested heavily in client education, which actually created the category of digital in India. And that's where we spent the bulk of our time. Maybe somewhere in New York or London or Paris, you know, in some global headquarters of some international MNC, you know, some ghanti went off and they said, global mandate, you've got to spend 5% of your budgets on digital. And then the memo came to India and, you know, the brand manager was like, okay, we got to do digital, but what the hell do we do, right? We don't know digital. And then some guy must have been like, oh, you remember those 19-year-old kids who came to pitch to us in their chaddis? Let's call them in and let's ask them. And then we get a call from Cadbury, and then we get a call from Axe, and then we get a call from L'Oreal, and then we get a call from Force India Racing saying, guys, come in. You guys have made a pitch to us about digital and now we have to do digital. So do it. And we said, okay.
One of the things that I realized, you know, just listening to your journey is, one, the industry was picking up the digital marketing thing. As you said, you had to do a lot of customer education. And one of the questions I wanted to ask you, but I've sort of found the answer now, is at 19, 20, 21, how do you make yourself presentable in a way where companies take you seriously? But the answer, I guess, is because this is a new trend that big agencies are not even looking at, right? Because small dollars, 5% of the overall budget, let's not care about. This is how the big agencies are thinking about. And that's where the new agencies really pop up. And this happens across different industries, right? Companies get bigger, start focusing on bigger clients, bigger things, leave out the small chunks behind, and new agencies and new businesses pop up. And seems like you guys had the same journey of like just sticking to digital and then growing with the industry.
I'll answer that question in 3 parts. You know, you spoke about presentability, and presentability, unfortunately, you know, by a lot of people is perceived as very superficial. And we were 19-year-old kids in our chaddis and chappals, quite literally, you know, and it's very hard for someone to take you seriously in that context. And in fact, a very close friend of mine who actually introduced us to L'Oreal, who's our first corporate, a large corporate client, which actually became the anchor for our Bombay office and made the agency, you know, for the early part of the last decade. He told me this, and he used to go to every single meeting in jeans and a t-shirt, like casually, semi, whatever, casually dressed, no shorts. And he told me this, and he was like, Suvir, it doesn't really make a difference what you wear, because they're not coming to meet you and judge you on the basis of what you're wearing. They're coming to meet you and judge you on the basis of what you're telling them. And you need to talk sense to them. Later in our life, we realized that talking sense to them meant 2 things. It meant, one, we have to always remember that we are the subject matter experts in the room. They are calling us in because we know digital. Not because they know digital and we are hands and legs to execute it, right? We are the subject matter experts in the room and they want our expertise. And that's one part of the puzzle. The second part of the puzzle is our expertise needs to apply to their business. So for that, we need to understand their business, which means we need to be able to have business conversations and talk about the impact that our work can potentially have on their business. How does this grow your brand? How does it grow your top line? How does it increase sales? How does it optimize cost? How do you save money? How do you increase profitability? And when I'm able to get these 2 hands to talk together, that's when I become presentable, right? Very later on in life, we realize that we say all this, but we also do it. We execute this work and we also demonstrate success. And when we demonstrate success, if I've demonstrated it for one client sees it, how do I demonstrate that same success for 10 other clients? And that's when we learned how to package that work in the form of a case study. And the presentability or the presentation that you talk about came across very nicely through case studies. And when you package your work well, and we used to always say that for us, our work will speak louder than we do, right? Let your work speak for itself. If you do great work and you put it out, you do not need to market yourself, because your work will speak for itself. People will see your work and say, hey, this is the good agency. They understand the consumer. They've understood the insight. Their execution is great. Their creative is great. let's get this agency on board, irrespective of, you know, the colloquial presentation that you're talking about. So we realized that your work will definitely speak for itself. Our work speaks for itself. And that was the presentability and the presentation that we kind of took forward to the market. And the third part that I'd like to very briefly touch upon is, because digital was young and new and cool and, you know, all those millennial buzzwords back in the day, and we were therefore, you know, the young, cool, new kids on the block, automatically we became marketable, right? We had a name like Foxymoron, which was very edgy. Our culture was, I mean, open door is a 90s buzzword when you talk about culture, right? We had a completely flat organizational structure. We were very, very well integrated with our teams. While, of course, we did have work-life balance, you know, it was, we did kind of work in a family setup where we were very close to our teams and therefore did really celebrate cultural congruity between, you know, the people that we worked with. And that translated into our work. That translated into our positioning as an organization in the industry. That translated into our position as an agency in our ecosystem as well. And that happened organically. We didn't work on that, right? We didn't write a script at 19 saying, this is who we want to be. We didn't even need to, we didn't even know we had to write a script. We needed to write a script. We know that today. But it happened organically. And the reason it happened is because small business, lean, founder-driven, it becomes an extension of your personality at the end of the day, right? We say that culture is always top-down. It becomes an extension of who you are. And if that is who you are and you're always fostering creativity and you're inclusive, then that's who your organization becomes and that's who your organization is known to be, should that reflect in your work. And that's exactly the philosophy we followed.
Makes sense. So digital marketing is growing. You've, you know, gotten case studies and referrals, stellar set of clients that are growing. One of the biggest things about agency, any kind of agency business, is you're heavily dependent on creative people because just founders themselves can't be the ones who are doing every single project, every single thing. This is a creative job and you need people who can sort of do these projects. How is the team building aspect of it? Just hiring the right people, training them, especially when you were young, attracting some people who were probably older than you. What was that journey like?
So I'm going to take half a step back and do a little bit of course correction, if you don't mind. I wouldn't say it's restricted to only creative people. I would say it's inclusive of all people. Today, we have as many creative people as we have business people, as we have strategy people, as we have technologists in our team. So I wouldn't only say creative people. I would say it's, you know, it's attracting all talent. Of course, because we sit in this advertising and marketing domain, people consider it to be a creative line of work, which is, you know, why people refer to it as a creative industry. But it's definitely the business guys and the tech guys and, you know, the planners and the strategists as well who are taken into account. So attracting talent, like you said, is one very big challenge. Retaining talent is the second challenge altogether. Keeping talent engaged is a third challenge altogether. When we were kids, we didn't understand much about talent, right? It was essentially, when we were 19, it was a bunch of other 19-year-old kids who were looking for an internship from my class itself and didn't get an internship. I was like, hey, come and intern with me. And they're like, cool, we'll come and intern with you. So my first few interns were basically just jobless kids from my batch. But we had some fun and we did something right? And eventually the story gets around that X kid from Y college from Z batch is doing something. And then you find kids from your own college who are like, hey, cool, this sounds fun. Maybe I should, you know, stick my head in the door and take a look at what you're, you know, doing. And the first maybe 15, 20, 30 employees that we got were from HR and Jay and then, you know, the colleges that we essentially went to. And our team was essentially constructed by people who were in our first or second degree of separation. And we took what we got. There was no question of being selective and I'm going to interview you and see whether you, you know, our interview was, how do you sell a comb to a bald man? That was our interview that we had at Barista one afternoon for some girls from HR who joined us because we didn't know any better at the age of 19 or 20, to be honest. In a couple of years, like I said, you know, in the previous question that we were talking about, our work started showing. Our work started speaking for itself because we were fortunate enough and privileged to have gotten the opportunity to work with some phenomenal brands like I named earlier. And very, very early on in our, you know, career, we also got the opportunity to work with various different agencies. You know, we worked very closely with Ogilvy and, you know, we closed the Cadbury business with them. We closed the Castrol business with them, for instance. We work very closely with GroupM and we close a bunch of businesses with them. We work very closely with Madison. So we've got the opportunity to work with a bunch of great agencies. And when we worked with agencies, we had the opportunity of looking at how their teams were structured, looking at who their people were, looking at how they design job descriptions, how they keep people motivated. And honestly speaking, that's something that genuinely interests me. So I actually sat up and take notice. I would call them and I'm like, once you become friends with agency guys, it's easy, right? You have a couple of beers and everyone's friends. And I'd be like, hey, do you mind sending me your job description? I want to model job descriptions in my organizations like that. And once you're friends with everyone, they want to help you. They want you to get a leg up in life. And I would pick out, you know, different pieces from different agencies, job descriptions, KRAs, KPIs, performance management, learning and development schedules, training schedules. And we had to build all of this from scratch, right? We didn't have some HR, fancy HR team that would do this for us. We didn't understand the impact of it. We didn't understand what it would cost us. But believe it or not, in 2011 or 2012, we were probably one of the first agencies in the country to get a chief learning officer on board, because we realized that no one knows digital, right? Anyone who gets into this industry, whether you're a 21-year-old kid from HR college or whether you're a 35-year-old advertising professional from Ogilvy, you get into this industry without knowing digital. Now, maybe me and a couple of other guys were painting a picture. We're painting a vision as to what digital will be. But how do I translate that vision onto 30 people in my team, 60 people in my team? As my team grows, it has to be scalable. It has to be consistent. Everything has to be scalable and consistent. So we were probably one of the first agencies in the country to get a chief learning officer on board and really spent money on organizational development. That again becomes a part of culture.
Subir, I have a question over here. You spoke about the importance of training, and this is what we have seen through our conversations with founders, is that a service business like you guys are has two ways of scaling up, right? You either hire really well or you train really well, or you do a combination of both, right? And you guys obviously did both. You guys were also really strong on the training part. Now, right now, in 2021, there's this phrase called knowledge management, and Siddharth is obsessed with knowledge management. And it's such a popular phrase, like every startup is talking about knowledge management, knowledge management, knowledge management. Now, this is back in the mid 2010s. We didn't have fancy tools like Notion and whatever else there is. Right? How were you guys doing knowledge management at that time? How are you taking the learnings that you were getting while working with clients, the learnings that you were getting while working with agencies, and how are you putting them like in a proper structured manner so that the entire team can learn from it?
So, Sahil, because you're from WPP, you have to remember that there are three ways to grow. You either hire well, you either train well, or if you can't do either of the two, then you just buy the next best guy.
That's true. WPP has bought so many companies. You're right.
Right. Yeah. So, but coming back to your question on knowledge management, like I said, so the first step was actually getting a product owner for knowledge, right? Because knowledge is decentralized, right? So I may have some, you may have some, Sahil may have some, Sid may have some, everyone may have some. How do you centralize it? And the first thing you got to do is you got to get a project owner who says, look, this is my job. I'm going to do this job. Because if everyone says I'm going to do it, then no one's going to do it. So the first thing we did is we got a guy to do it. We got really, really fortunate because in 2011 or 12, I don't remember which year, there was Symbiosis, there was Wellinker's Institute of Management, and there was somebody else who came to us saying, hey, look, you guys are doing digital marketing. It's clearly going to become a big deal. Why don't you hire students from our schools? You know, come in and do pre-placement talks and stuff like that. And then we went in and we did pre-placement talks and these kids knew nothing. And we went back and we told the teachers that these kids know nothing. Why the hell would we hire them? Because you got to pay twice as much for MBA kids as you do for BCom or BA or BSc kids. And they know as little or as much about digital. So one smart teacher came back and she's like, great. They know nothing. Why don't you teach them? So between 2011 and 2013, we have sat down and created MBA course curriculum. Not only created, but taught MBA course curriculum to MBA kids who were in these schools that I named previously without having done MBAs ourselves. So we were teaching kids who were 3, 4, 5 years work X now going back to do their MBA in B schools without even knowing what a B school entails. I'd never even bothered Googling what happens in B school because I started the agency at 19. There was no question of going to B school after that. But what that did is it forced us to organize our knowledge. It forced us to organize information because now all of a sudden we had to put in a structured pattern where kids who are students, excuse me, who are used to or trained to learn in a structured pattern are able to digest this information. So it took months and months of planning and organizing curriculum, it literally was curriculum into various different semesters and modules and testing and evaluation and retesting. And all of this is done not with an academic lens, because we're not academics or we're not academicians. We are pracademicians. We are practicing academics, right? Because now we're building curriculum, but we're also practicing the vocation of advertising. So all of this was done keeping in mind that the lens is purely practical, that all of this information needs to be used by somebody when they get into the workforce. This is not me learning how to, you know, tally a ledger account in my 11th standard commerce paper when I don't think I'm going to ever have to do that in my life, you know, ever again after my 11th standard commerce paper. So practical knowledge. So we learned pedagogy at a very, very young age. And that, you know, the good use case of the word as well. And we were forced to manage this information. It may have happened in the format of, you know, discourses, lectures, PowerPoint presentations, etc., which was rudimentary back then. But also destiny led us to this company called Noesis Knowledge Solutions Private Limited, which is now the technology solutions provider, part of the Zoom Media Group that we run. And Noesis was a forerunner in the edtech industry as early as 2008 or 2009. Noesis actually had built one of India's first edtech products called Gyan Exchange. And I think the name tells you what it does. It's a learning management platform that was built in 2008 or 9 called Gyan Exchange. Noesis is our technology company today. When we partnered with Noesis, we inherited the software and the platform. And now we're able to organize our information in such a constructive fashion. And all of it becomes scalable. All of it is consistent across various different patterns, because now we've learned how to create or how to craft pedagogy. And now the tech helps us scale it up as well. So it happened very naturally. It was like, it was a fluke, but everything and all good things in life are.
Recently, some friends of mine asked me to give them a 2-3 hour lecture on SEO. Yeah. And then I had to organize all of my knowledge to give them that lecture on SEO. And then I had to take 4 or 5 years of learning it and my practice and then putting it into slides and presentations and all of that stuff. And then I realized that, oh, these are my gaps. This is what I need to get better at. And this is what I know really, really, really well. Now I'm just thinking about what the impact of this is for other startups, other people who are starting out, right? Is that the way that you can get better, the way you can manage the knowledge is just take teams, take your learnings and just teach them.
Absolutely.
Like have like a multi-session thing, right? About some topic in your business. You can't expect that somebody will just come in and just be like, hi, yeah, I'm the expert at this. Once you manage that knowledge, then it's there forever. And all you have to do is update it.
Just to add here, I think the thing is very few startups really actually do it, because the return on investment is not very obvious. At least in the short run, it's not very obvious, right? The amount of effort that a founder or a leader has to put in to create this curriculum is immense. It's a lot of work. And your alternative is, should I work on a client project? Should I go do a new sale versus building this curriculum? Because I guess you had to do that course. You had no option once you committed to, you know, a Symbiosis, you have to actually go out and do the course. Versus if it was just an internal sort of KPI, internal project, may or may not have happened.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're very right, actually. You know, I'll answer that question. I'll talk about the startup part first, and then I'll go back to our experience as well. Like I said, category creation, when we had to go to pitch our business to advertisers, our clients, our potential customers, they knew nothing about digital. So the minute we started talking about terminology, you know, technicality, we had lost their attention spans. You could see them zoning out, because now it's like, you know, so we had to dumb it down. We had to give them the basics. So we learned our business by dumbing it down for someone who didn't know it, right? We were just adapting the use case, saying it's a client today, it's a student tomorrow, it's a team member day after. And I also in my personal life have realized that I've also been able to use that same philosophy going forward, like with startups, like you guys say, right? So one of the startups that I was fronting made it to a program called Y Combinator, which I'm sure you guys are familiar with, which is one of the largest incubators in the world. And in YC, in the prep, like when you read their blog articles and you watch the videos on YouTube, they say that your pitch should be so simple that even your grandmother understands what you do. The more jargon you use, the more complicated you make it, the more you don't understand your own business or you're not convinced by it, which is why you're trying to find marketability. But if you're finding marketability easily, then your business is marketable, right? So I think the beauty is in the simplicity And Sid, you're very right. It takes hours, days, weeks to find that simplicity, or call it that curriculum, call it whatever you want, to be able to convey, explain what you're doing to somebody in a very coherent fashion, which is scalable, which is consistent, and which is regular, right? Because training cannot be, oh, I've done this once and, you know, I'm done, I'm a master now. You got to do it every 3 months, every 6 months, especially in our industry where things are changing so quickly.
What I want to do right now, you mentioned WPP, you mentioned Oakley, you mentioned Madison. As somebody who's not from this industry, I don't really understand how this thing works, right? These are large agencies. Do they partner with smaller agencies? Do they buy? What is the entire industry structure, if you can help us understand this?
So the industry structure is that there are, I would say, the big four, and there are two more. So like six advertising networks that pretty much control 85% of all advertising around the country, around the world, excuse me. These advertising networks are essentially holding companies. Their job is to own agencies, and the job of the agency is to build, nurture relationships with clients and deliver excellence and deliver solutions. So, for instance, the largest two creative agencies in the world historically have been Ogilvy and Mather and JWT, and JWT is obviously now pivoted and, you know, reconsolidated, etc. JWT and O&M were both owned, are both owned by the same holding company, which is WPP. The largest media trading company in the world, which is GroupM, again owned by WPP. Genesis, one of the largest PR agencies in the world, owned by WPP. In India, some of the, you know, Indian marquee advertising agencies, contract advertising, etc., owned by WPP. As far as digital is concerned, you have agencies like Glitch, owned by WPP, for instance. So the job of, the role of WPP in this construct is that of a holding company that actually just owns other agencies who then foster relationships with their clients and, like I said, deliver kick-ass work and obviously make money in the process of doing so. And like WPP, you've got a Publicis and you've got a Dentsu and an Omnicom and an IPG and a Havas. And these are, you know, typically the six big networks. And now you've got a lot of Asian networks, you know, that are also emerging. There's Blue Focus from China. There's, you know, some great networks from Japan, Haku Hodo, ADK, etc., that are doing some phenomenal work. Now, typically, these agencies, these networks own agencies. These agencies harbor relationships with clients, and these agencies are able to deliver products and services. So it's not, I mean, it shouldn't be rocket science for a agency to, who has a relationship with 100 clients and is delivering five services to them, to now deliver a sixth service to those same 100 clients. So you're delivering print, television, radio, outdoor events, activations. Can you add digital to this wheelhouse? Theoretically, it shouldn't be rocket science to do it. But what is the fundamental mistake in the early 2010s that these agencies made is they put gray hair guy to do a job of a black haired guy. Right. So they said that let the experience prevail. And unfortunately, that formula failed because the gray-haired guy was not as agile, not as tactile, didn't have a mobile phone in his hand from the time that he was in college or a kid. You know, he's still waking up and reading the newspaper. We were still waking up and reading the newspaper every day as well. But we had already moved to gaining a lot of knowledge and information from the internet. So that was a fundamental mistake they made. They realized that they tried to build it on their own, but they weren't wildly successful. I wouldn't say they weren't successful, but they weren't wildly successful. We, on the other hand, had the opportunity, like I said, no baggage, blah, 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 in the introduction. And we were able to scale from length to length very, very quickly. To give you a sense of how quickly we started our agency in 2008 with no money, our seed capital was $1,000, which was the equivalent of 64,000 rupees back in the day. And on a seed capital of 64,000 rupees, we were a 300 member agency in 5 years. Completely organically, on the back of working with clients, like I said, Axe, L'Oreal, Pepsi, blah, blah, blah. Really colorful client list because of the opportunity that we got. And we grew organically from a 4-member team with 64,000 rupees to a 300 member team with millions of dollars in revenue every year. And that was all organic over a period of 5 years. So the big boy said, look, we're obviously doing something wrong. The fact that these kids are getting it right and we're getting it wrong obviously means, you know, that there's a, you know, there's something wrong in our approach. And like we joked about, you know, ways to scale and grow your company. If you can't build it, what do? You buy it, right? So then in 2012, they went and started knocking on, you know, everyone's door. There were, between 2012 and 2020, about 20 agencies, you know, who, like us, had started about 15 years ago, who knew what they're doing, who had great relationships with clients, etc. Of those 20 agencies, about 18 today are partnered with. When I say partnered with, I mean have been acquired by network agencies such as the six that I named previously, the six networks that I named previously. And as acquired agencies, they function under the ambit of the network. They pitch to network clients. They consolidate their services with whichever parent agency they're aligned with. And yeah, and they fit under the construct of network goals, network vision, network structure, etc. In 2014, our door was knocked on. Between 2014 and 2018, I would say, or 19, our door was knocked on very aggressively by a number of such networks who we had no idea. I mean, we didn't know what mergers and acquisitions were back in 2014. For context, I was 25 years old. That was only a term I had read in the newspaper, and I didn't know how many zeros were in a million. I'm just joking. Math is my best friend. But you get where I'm going with this, right? We were very, very new to the world of corporate development and had absolutely no idea what a management information system was and what corporate due diligence was and stuff like that. And all of a sudden, you've got these networks coming down and they want to conduct a valuation exercise and they want to do DD and they want to give you a term sheet. And I'd never even heard these terms in my life before. Like I said, I come from a family of lawyers and we do real estate law and you know, that kind of stuff, which doesn't really involve any amount of corporate development and mergers and acquisitions. So this is a completely whole new world for me, and I guess whole new learning curve as well. And the learning curve is twofold. One is this corporate development and valuations and stuff like that, which is today so commonplace because Zomato did a lakh crores on an IPO and Nykaa is doing a 50,000 crore rupee IPO and everyone's talking about, you know, valuation and funding and unicorns and sunicorns and, you know, and 10 years ago, but I guess, you know, it wasn't as glamorous, if I may say so. So we did, there was, you know, this horse and pony show where we had to go and like prop ourselves up and look really pretty because people would come from France to meet you and Japan to meet you and the US to meet you and UK to meet you. And I remember for the first time in our lives, we put on a jacket and went to a meeting. And I looked at my partner and I was like, who are you? And he looked at me and he's like, who are you? You know, because we didn't wear jackets. So we used to wear shorts and go to meetings. So anyway, so we did this whole horse and pony show and we danced around and we got these fancy term sheets, too many zeros for us to count on when we were 25. Signed one term sheet as well. Fortunately, only signed a term sheet and didn't really move forward. But I think the important part of this journey for us was that we got exposed to the institutionalized and corporatized way of running advertising agencies as businesses. So all the stuff that I did with my friends offline, which was how do you set your job descriptions, KRAs, KPIs, build systems, processes, build for scale, management information systems, track profitability, track productivity, track efficiency, all of this stuff, which I had no idea about prior to, all of a sudden I learned all of this in 2 to 3 years because all these corporate guys are doing this in such an amazing fashion, right? They're able to track their businesses down to, you know, base level of granularity and ensure that every single person, every single business department is able to perform. And that's how you really build a business when you're aware and you keep everybody accountable.
I want to just narrate a story over here. One of my aunts, she was the CFO of a WPP holding company in one of the regions, right? And what used to happen every year is that the CEO of WPP and the founder, whatever, he used to go to every single branch office every year and sit down with the CFOs of every single one of them and go through every single number of every single branch office of all of their holding companies. And that is, I think, dozens of them. I don't even know how many. And that was the granularity, because you're talking about the granularity that they used to go at, right? So that was the granularity that WPP used to go at. And for those people who might not know, WPP is like a tens of billions dollars company. I don't even know, man. But yeah, sorry, that just reminded me of that story.
That's a very fascinating entire industry structure where you're saying six networks basically control 80 to 85% of the business. So basically for a new agency, a lot of them probably go in with the ideal outcome of being acquired by one of these companies, right? Because as you said, at 25, too many zeros to count. So if you get it right for 3-4 years, if you catch on a new trend and if you're able to build a good agency business, you'll probably get acquired by one of these companies, right?
You know, to be funny, when we started, and I'll talk about a point of view here. When we started running this business, we didn't start building the business for valuation. We didn't start building the business to be acquired. We didn't even know that was an option, to be honest. And I also find that comes from lineage of Indian businesses. Inherently, if you look at businesses in India like to be profitable. We build businesses for healthy P&Ls. We have never generationally built businesses on the basis of balance sheets, chasing value, chasing valuation. Doesn't make a difference if I'm burning through 300 crores a year, but I'm still valued at $1.45 billion. And that's what's important to me. The fact that I'm investable is important to me. This has never been a format to conduct businesses in India as it has been for the last 6, 7, 8 years, while this startup culture has been really booming and has been celebrated. So that's always the legacy that we grew up with, right? The first time you picked up the Economic Times and you read a newspaper article and you saw that profits were surging quarter on quarter. Therefore, shareholders were happy. So shareholders are happy because the company is doing well, i.e. is profitable. And that's what everyone in our generation related to as the idea of a business doing well. So in our eyes, for our business to do well, we had to grow and scale the business and do, you know, crores and crores of rupees worth of turnover, but also increase our profitability simultaneously. We were not doing it with the intention of increasing valuation so that someone would come and buy us out. So I don't think we even knew that it was an option that time. Of course, today we do. Of course, today everyone does. Entering the business, everyone knows that this is an option for them. But I find that ambition really decides what you want to do, right? Someone could say, hey, look, I want to build and scale an agency. I want to create value for myself and exit in 5 to 7 years because it'll fetch me 50 crore rupees and I have a nest egg in my bag, you know, in my back pocket, life is secure and I can then start investing in 1, 2, 3, 4 other businesses. Someone may say, hey, look, I want to be a career lifer. I want to do advertising for the next 40 years. That's how long it takes to build an agency. Gestation period is 2 generations. It's 40 years to build an agency, right? And I'm going to give it that time. I want to leave legacy behind. I want to give my kids something. I want them to give their kids something. I want this to become a lineage. I want this to become a brand that everyone in the country and everyone in the world hopefully knows and aspires to work with either as a client or as an advertising professional. And that's one chain of thought to go down. As we retained our independence, we realized naturally we lean in the second direction. We are building legacy. We're building lineage. We're building a brand. If we had to sell, we would have already sold by now, like I said, cashed out for millions of dollars and probably been on our third startup by now, right? That inherently as an idea doesn't seem exciting because what is motivating you? Money is motivating you. You're linking your idea of success to money. That's not my idea of success. Money doesn't motivate me at all. I shouldn't say at all, but money is not my motivator to do things. And it's not a driver, right? And as a result, you're not operating from that place of trying to create personal wealth. You're trying to create legacy. You're trying to create a brand. You're trying to create an institution.
This term sheet experience that you went through probably led to a lot of introspection on what you wanted to build, because before that it was, hey, day to day, let's grow the business. Let's take it somewhere. And suddenly you have this term sheet in front of you and now you're forced to think, should I take this? Should I take this? Should I not take this? Right? The fact that you didn't take it and went on to build that model where you started acquiring agencies yourself, smaller agencies yourself in different domains. That's how Zoo Media was born. Take us through that journey of what Zoo Media does. And before you go there, whoever comes up with the names in your company is just, you know, the entire network of the 7 agencies that you have within Zoo Media, the names are on point. They leave a mark. So kudos to whoever comes up with the names, but tell us that journey of like acquiring the agencies and building, maybe 40 years down the line, a competitive WPP, as you said, takes 2 generations, but you're on that journey now.
So in the term sheet, there was one term that was our inflection point. That term was CAGR, which today everyone knows is compounded annual growth rate. I didn't know at that point of time what CAGR was. For the listeners who don't know what CAGR is, compounded annual growth rate essentially is the growth rate that a company grows year on year, compounding from last year to this year, essentially. And there were a variety of different targets, which is understandable. Sales grow by this much, revenue grows by this much, profit grows by this much. And then there was CAGR, and there was a CAGR kicker. And I was like, cool, what's the CAGR thing? So I spoke to my advisor, I did some research, etc. And I was like, okay, so this basically means that I'm just going to take any and all business that comes my way because I have to hit the CAGR kicker, right? Because I'm desperate to grow the business because I have to hit my targets. And then I had a conversation with my partner, Prateek, and I was like, do we want to take any and all business that comes in? And we had a serious sit down face to face. And the consensus that we reached was, hell no, we don't want to take any and all business that comes in, right? Assuming that the business is profitable and all that stuff, the basic, you know, it's meeting all the commercial parameters. And the reason why we answered this question in the fashion that we did is because we said, what is the most important thing to us at this stage of our lives? We were 25 years old, we're highly impressionable, etc. But we also realized that we were impressionable. We were sponges, right? We were like soaking in something from every different experience, every different person we interacted with. And we were also conscious of these experiences. So we were also conscious of the fact that if you have a bad experience with someone, you may be soaking in negativity. So what is important when you're at such an impressionable stage of your career? The most important thing for us at that point of time was to soak in positivity, which means that we have to surround ourselves with good people. So we said the most important thing for us and the cornerstone for anything that we do in life is to work with good people. And what are good people? Good people are not necessarily people who chase the same goals as you. Good people aren't necessarily people who are as ambitious as you. I like the fact today that I have certain partners that are way more ambitious than I am. I like the fact that I am more ambitious than certain partners and I can give them a kick up their ass and we can all work hard together, right? But good people essentially are people who share value systems with you, right? And we celebrate our values at the organization very, very deeply. And this is something that I talk about, which is very close to my heart personally as well. Our value systems at Zoo, we call them ICE Cube, I-C-E-E-E. Integrity, creationism, empathy, excellence, and endurance. These are the five values that we celebrate. And inherently, if people get along on their basis of their value systems, then you're building constructive relationships for the future. If not, then it's transactional. You may need me today, I may need you tomorrow, we may be gone for tomorrow. We may be gone day after. And the same logic works whether you talk about building a team, whether you talk about partners, whether you talk about clients, whether you talk about vendors, talks about everyone, because India has always been a country in which you do business basis relationships. You build a relationship and then if the relationship is good, you do business for 10, 20 years. You do business for a lifetime, right? So we said this to ourselves as well, that inherently if we find clients who come to us with differential value systems and value systems that we don't believe in, right? Everyone is entitled to their own value system and their own opinion. But value systems that we inherently don't believe in, then maybe we should choose proactively to not work with these clients. And we would like to have that choice. We would like to have the choice to decide what direction we want to go in, and more importantly, what direction we would want to grow in. And that was a pivotal moment where we said that we might want to take a step back. So it was the CAGR kicker. I'll answer the second question, which was essentially the journey of how we built Zoo from there. So like I said, the journey, the direction I want to go in and the direction I want to grow in, right? Both become equally important. What we realized, so good, we established good people, we established value systems. What we also realized is that everyone asked us, what is the story of the agency of the future? And everyone spoke about, you know, like we position ourselves to sit at the intersection of content, media, data, tech. And early 2010s, you noticed that some guys were content creative specific, some guys were media performance programmatic specific, some guys became tech agencies. We always sat at the intersection of each. But we also realized that as this generalist agency grows and blossoms, there needs to be subject matter expertise, right? Like I said right in the beginning, the reason we are in the room is because we are subject matter experts and our clients want to hear from us. So we have to build subject matter expertise, which is very, very deep in certain domains. And that's where we created the Center of Excellence model, saying that even though we have a generalist agency, which was Foxy Moron back in 2016, we need to have centers of excellence who focus specifically on one thing and dive really deep over there. So they're almost like, you know, they're almost like a special tactical forces that come in for certain objectives, meet those objectives and get out. And then they can be shopped around from client to client to client. And they don't have to be married to a client. So long as my agency relationship with the client is cemented and I'm, you know, working with them for 3, 5, 7 years, my special tactical teams can come in and go depending on work that needs to be executed. And that's when our ancillary agencies were born, our sister agencies were born. The first was Phosphine, which is our creative tech company, VR, AR, MR. We did a lot of work with filters, camera tech. We do a lot of work with image recognition. We do a lot of work with NLP. We're doing some great work with token auctions now, which is where Paul and I, influencer management and talent company, came in, which is where Rabbit Hole, which is our production house, came in. We partnered with Noesis, which was an external agency, and brought them in as a marketing tech company. Today, they do some great work with community, with commerce, with education, intersecting ad tech with marketing tech. We brought in another agency that specializes on D2C e-commerce startup scaling. It was a combination of build and buy for us as well, of course. But the ideology came from the fact that we needed centers of excellence. Each of these centers of excellence then became agencies on their own. They're all entities on their own. They all have their own leadership, which means now we can keep individuals individually incentivized as well, right? And people have a lot of room to grow across the network because now there are, you know, centers of excellence and units which are agencies on their own in their own right. And because we're relatively young, tightly held, closely run, it's very easy for us to integrate and amalgamate the beauty of all these companies with one another. So that's where, you know, the idea for birthing our own network really came from.
That makes sense, right? Because when you started 2011-12, the market wasn't deep enough for you to have specialized agencies, specialized solutions. But 2014-15-16, for example, I think Rabbit Hole, which is your video consulting, video solutions provider, right? 2011, this was not a big enough field for a separate standalone agency. But as the market grew, that's where the need for individual verticals started growing. And I like the entire approach of build versus buy. It gives you the flexibility to say that, hey, if there's something that's good out there, let's just go and out acquire them. If there's a good team, which, you know, matches your value system and everything, let's go out and acquire and sort of build the network versus trying to build it on our own. Love that approach. One of the things that you mentioned during the course was it's a profitable business. It's one of those businesses that if you get right, it's a highly cash flowing, profitable business. In whatever way you can, help us understand the finances of this industry or the profitability of this industry. Where I sit, you know, outside of the industry, what I've heard is it's generally a percentage of the overall budget, right? Like if somebody's spending something on digital, they'll 10% of that budget is your fee. Is that the sort of, you know, the rule on how this works, or are the different sort of pricing strategies that happen in this industry?
So there are three business models. I'll call them business models that are industry followers. The first model that you spoke about is the commission model. That's the oldest model. The commission model was based on the fact that prior to the 90s, advertising agencies were not split into creative and media agencies. It was one agency that actually managed the entire mandate. So I'll go back to my JWT example. Today, if there was an advertiser who went to JWT and said, look, I want to do a television commercial, JWT would say, okay, look, these are all the channels. So this is the TG. These are the channels that we'll advertise on. Your spend is 100 rupees. And the advertiser would pay them 100 rupees with a 15% commission. And inside that 15% commission, they had to do two things. One is produce the ad and then cover all their overhead costs, their staff costs, etc. And obviously, hopefully take home a certain amount of money as profit as well. So that's a standard trading commission model. Today, the trading commission model applies only to trading events, which is predominantly buying and selling, buying media planning and buying. So in the digital industry, when I say media planning and buying, I mean, it's Google ads, Facebook ads, Instagram ads, performance ads, affiliates ads, programmatic advertising, etc., where we earn a commission from what our clients spend. There are a lot of in brackets, you know, earning tools, like you have incentive structures and volume discounts and stuff like that. But they all more or less fall into the ambit and the wheelhouse of a trading or a commission model. The second model, which is wildly popular, is called a fee-based model. In a fee-based model, essentially, we get paid a certain fee for man hours committed and invested in building and in executing tasks. So the tasks could be anything that functions on what we call a retainer in our industry. So in a retainer, you have a fixed team structure who commit a dedicated number of hours to output a certain number of deliverables on a month-on-month basis. And we get paid a fixed fee for this. In the fixed fee, which is what we call a retainer, we need to budget for three components. One is the staff cost, two is the overhead cost, and three is obviously your profit margin. The retainer-based model is a highly regulated model because as your investments in digital start increasing, your clients have the flexibility of negotiating the ratio between A, B, and C. A, B, and C being your staff cost, your overhead cost, and your profit margin. And this becomes a very regulated and regimented format of pricing because the retainer stays the same for the period of the contract. So if I have a 12-month contract, I'm getting paid the same amount of money for 12 months. And therefore, at no point of time can I ever make more or less money on that contract. The third business model that we use is called the production model. It's a very simple model to understand. It's a cost-plus model. Making a TV ad, my cost is 100 rupees. I slap on a 30% margin. I sell it to the client for 130 rupees. When I say my cost, I mean the cost of renting a camera and lights and location and actors and directors. The cost for all of that is 100 bucks. I add a margin on it, which is called cost plus. And inside that margin, I manage my overhead costs, my staff costs, obviously make a profit margin. So agencies like us, which are integrated agencies, we use a blend of all three models for the various different services that we offer. But if there's only a trading agency, they would work only on a commission basis. If there was only a production house or a tech company, they would work only on a cost plus model. We have the freedom and flexibility to work across all three models because of the diverse products and services that we offer to our clients.
A few more questions before we close it out. The build versus buy thing, specifically on the buy thing, the acquisition, how are companies valued in this industry? Is it as simple as revenue multiples? Is it the kind of clients that you have? What's the acquisition sort of valuation? How's the valuation done in this industry?
So hard and soft metrics. The hard metric today that all companies are used to be valued is PAT, profit after tax. And there's a PAT multiplier that companies are the buyer will use to value the seller. So there are formulas. So like, for example, if the purchase year is N, they'll say N minus one plus, N minus one, N and N plus one. So they'll take a 3-year average of your PAT and then they'll give you a multiplier. The multipliers could range anywhere between 8 and 15 times profit after tax. And the question really is, what dictates the multiplier? Why would X agency get 8 and why would X agency get 12 and why would another agency get 15? And that's where the intangibles come in, right? So the intangibles are, what is the value of the brand, right? So today, for example, Foxy Moron is a very, very strong and powerful brand in the industry. It's a brand that everybody knows, everybody wants to work with, clients, people, etc. What is the value of capability that you have, right? So we've got best-in-class creative teams, best-in-class content teams, best-in-class performance marketing teams, etc. What is the value, what is the value of the client roster? So you've got clients who you have contracts with for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, etc. When a buyer comes in with their amplification, can you make a 100 rupee contract into 150 rupee contract? So what is the value of the contracts? Four is, what is the value of the team, right? Do they have a good team? Do they have a good leadership team? Do they have good, whatever, directors? Do they have good founders, etc.? And fifth is, do they have any intellectual property, right? Like, so do they have any proprietary tech? Do they have any proprietary platforms, etc.? So these become the intangibles. And the better the intangibles, the higher the multiplier and vice versa.
One follow-up question. When you acquire these businesses, I'm assuming a lot of the founders or the leadership have a lot of skin in the game even after the acquisition for them to sort of be incentivized to grow the business. Is that how WPP or in general the acquisitions work in this industry?
Usually, yes. Usually a strategic investor will buy 51% of an agency. 51% does two things. One is, of course, it gives them control because they're the majority shareholder. And two, also by RBI guidelines, they're allowed to consolidate balance sheets officially and report that company's revenue on a consolidated balance sheet, which means that impacts stock price, etc., so on and so forth. And yes, that also means that there's enough skin in the game for the founder to be incentivized to continue growing, continue building the company. What these large strategic investors also do, though, is the balance 49%, they give founders an earnout, which means that they say that, look, we're happy to liquidate your position from 49% down to maybe 29%. And the 20% of value that you create will be co-created because we're buying your company today, but we'll give you the same multiple of 12x on the value that you create with us as well. So assuming that the strategic partner brings millions of dollars of new business with it, you get the upside of that as well. So it's called an earnout.
From a founder perspective who's getting acquired, the biggest factor, apart from obviously the money that they're able to cash out and sort of the value that they can take out of the business for what they've created, is also the client roster that you can now reach out to basis the power of the network, right? I'm assuming that's a big factor in how they decide if they make sense. Okay, one last question to close it out. What's the future for Zoom Media now? What are you thinking? What's the next 5-year plan of sorts?
Cool. So Zoom Media, I'm going to answer that question in two parts. The Zoom Media Group today is known to be a advertising and marketing service provider. Like I said, we sit at the intersection of content, media, data, and tech. The idea for us, as far as our own growth is concerned, is to on the Zoom Media group side is we continuously grow our products and services in terms of our offering. Like I said, we're most recently moving into the D2C space. We're just closing an acquisition right now with an agency that works specifically with startups to scale their digital journeys. And that's on the agency and services side. What we're really excited about, though, is two new initiatives that we're championing over the course of 2020. One is, we recently set up Mammoth Media, which is our media IP holdings and tradings company, which we're really excited about. We launched a men's lifestyle portal a couple of months ago called manslife.in. And over the course of next year, we're going to transform that magazine into a content community commerce destination and really champion the cause of social commerce. Simultaneously, we're in the process of developing long-form content with OTT platforms as well, and we're going to have our own shows in various different languages, our own movies, fiction, non-fiction, across various different platforms, and going to function as a media company. The third thing that we're doing also is, along with our tech partners, is we've pivoted and created a new social commerce company. We love the gig economy. We love the creator economy, and we're very, very gung-ho about changing the face of how Indians shop online through social commerce. Having said that, we're taking a step outside of our wheelhouse, which is marketing and marketing services, and actually pivoting to products, because we've never run a products company before. We've never run a media company before. These are new experiences for us. We're really, really excited for these experiences. But what we're most excited about in 2022 is, and something that I spoke about very actively in 2020, and my heart hurts to say this, but pandemic, and we couldn't do anything about it, and we shrugged our shoulders. But in January of 2020, I said that we want to globalize our company. We definitely want to be an agency that goes global, that internationalizes itself. I think all these holding companies that we spoke about, whether it's Dentsu or Omnicom or Publicis or IPG or whoever the case may be, all international companies that come to India and harness Indian talent. India's got the best tech in the world. Historically, India's got great creativity. And when I say historically, I mean I'm going all the way back to the Indus Valley civilization, right? We've always had great creativity in India, and we still do. And it's time for India to get its moment and shine. And as an independent agency today, we have the freedom and flexibility to make these decisions to put ourselves on a global map. We have the freedom and flexibility to say that, look, where we have the privilege and the liberty of now breaking barriers and entering new markets. And as opposed to global agencies entering India and buying Indian companies, can we do the reverse? Can Indian networks now, although we're very nascent and small as a network, is it the opportunity over the next 20 years for Indian networks to break the boundaries and go overseas and have their own organic and inorganic growth journeys? And that's a narrative that we're chasing very, very aggressively. And that's our five-year plan.
Actually, this is a thesis that I have, that Indian content creators, I mean, Indian content in general can be sold at a global level, because we speak English so well. We can create content. We have the production houses. We have the entire infrastructure of Bollywood, right? It's something that can be done in India, and I agree with you, it can be globalized as well.
I'm very curious, Veer, how your role has changed from managing one company, Foxy Moron, to now looking at, the different agencies that you work with, and also thinking far out in the future on building a lot of this. How has your role evolved over a period of time?
So, Siddharth, the reality is that I'm still very early in my career. I've been working for only 15 years, and I know I hopefully have another 50 years ahead of me. But in the limited period of experience that I've gained, and I like to believe that we've run a few races so far already, something that I learned actually from, I think he's the world's richest man today. I don't know what keeps happening in that Tesla, Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook ecosystem. I don't know who's winning the race, but I think Bezos is the richest man in the world today. I don't know, maybe.
No, Elon Musk now, man.
It can change tomorrow. So it
that's what matter. I said. The race is like, yeah. Someone puts out one meme and now Shiba Inu rides the wave and everyone's a few $1 million richer. So not billion in their case, but whatever. So January 2020, we were doing some work in social commerce, and we want to, do some work with Amazon seller, and Jeff Bezos was down in Delhi, and Sid and I, went up to Delhi. Very, very interesting insight, he shared. He said that when he started his career and he started Amazon as e-commerce, no one really understood the concept of buying books online. So, it was very important to articulate the what question. What are you doing, right? What does selling books online mean? Or what does selling online really mean? Customer journey, customer acquisition, blah, 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 right? There's a little bit of definition of product and process that's really required. So he spent the first part of his career answering the what question. Now you've answered the what question, you figure out your product. Now you've got to scale up your product, right? You've got to take it to different countries, different products, different markets, different industries. How do you do that, right? So you've got to build processes, you know, you've got to build systems, you've got to, you know, network with partners. So the second stage of your career is busy answering the how question. How do I scale up? How do I achieve efficiency? How do I achieve profitability? The third stage of your career, not that I'm in the third stage of my career, but I like to believe that I'm answering this question today, is after we've answered the what am I doing? How am I doing it? The next stage of your career, you're answering the question, who is helping me do this, right? The Zoom Media Network exists as a network today because we work with a variety of different agencies, which means that gives us the privilege of working with some of the most sharpest minds in the country who either have been homegrown minds from inside of our network or partners who we shake hands with and you know and work with as partners. And I don't use the word shake hands very lightly because our partners today are all equity partners. We're in bed with each of our partners and we own portions of each other's companies. Excuse me. So that gives us the privilege of answering the question, asking the question, who is going to help me scale this vision? For us, it becomes imperative that obviously we hold that vision at the center, which, you know, which I said about 15 minutes ago, saying that we really hold that vision at the center and it's important for everyone to buy into that vision. But who's going to drive what piece of the pie? If I decide to do something new tomorrow, who's going to lead that? And if I'm not able to answer the who question, then I'm not even starting answering the larger question, saying, how am I growing or how am I scaling? So today I feel like I'm at my career where I'm answering the who question, which means that a lot of my time gets spent on, like we said, stakeholder management, expectation setting, organizational development. And answering that who question, I have the privilege today of working with partners who are my age in our early 30s and partners who are in their 70s. Never in my life would I have imagined that I'd be partnering with people who've got 50 years of work ex. And no matter how sharp we are when it comes to digital, you can never take away 50, 60 years of work experience, right? That's a lifetime of work experience. And all of a sudden, I have the privilege of learning from people like these who are now not my mentors, but are my partners. They're in the ranks with me. When COVID happens, they get hit. They're struggling to keep their head above water like us. They're not my mentors sitting on, you know, one side of the pyramid who have the privilege of, you know, telling us how it's done. But they're in the ranks with you, but you're still learning so much from them every single day. And this, I think, has been such a rewarding part of the journey that I am on in life right now, professionally, in terms of answering the who question, because it's just filled our eyes and our hearts and our lives with so much enthusiasm and positivity, keeping in mind that these people buy into our value systems, keeping in mind that these people buy into our vision, keeping in mind that we all get along, right? Fundamentals have to be in place first.
Okay. Suvir, absolutely. Last question. I promise I'll keep Siddharth away if he tries again. You started your career at 19. Obviously, what money meant for you at 19 versus now you are our age, but you're running a very successful business. What does money mean for you now? How has your relationship with money changed in these past 14, 15 years?
So it's really funny, actually. I have never been a money guy, but at work, I am the money guy. At work, I am the money guy because I think it just requires the most disciplined guy to put his hand up and say, look, I'll be the money guy, because money requires an immense amount of discipline. And if you're not disciplined with your money, we've heard hundreds of stories of how people have squandered away their wealth, right? So I guess it required a certain amount of discipline and it required a certain amount of judgment as well. I don't know whether I can give any credit to my genes or I'm Sindhi and therefore business is in your blood, etc. That blah, blah, blah. Maybe, I don't know. But it comes naturally to me. It comes easily to me. I feel like for my team, specifically for my team and not for me, money becomes a yardstick of measurement of how far we are going, how fast we are running, to a certain extent, maybe how well we are doing in context to standard of living as well. For me, maybe I'm speaking from a place of privilege because I had the privilege of growing up in a house where I got 3 square meals on the table and, you know, I didn't have to make that my first priority when it came to working, which meant that at the age of 19, I could proactively take the risk of wanting to start up and not have the pressure of being able to have put meals on the table for myself or anyone that was depending on me. So maybe that is a place of privilege that I do speak from. But that place of privilege gave me a lot of confidence to make the decisions that I made today. Having said that, my relationship with money hasn't changed at all. I've grown up as a very simple human being who's never needed more money in my wallet than I need to buy a Sevpuri at the bottom of the road. My lifestyle is a very, very simple lifestyle. The only thing I love indulging in is being in the outdoors, is adventure. So I just need as much money as can take me out of the city to do the things that I love, which is not a lot of money. So my relationship with money is actually very meager. It's very simple. And for my team, I like to use that as a yardstick of how far we're going, how fast we're running. And in context to world economy at large, it becomes a benchmark for our performance.
Thanks a lot, Suvi. This was very fascinating. The entire journey that you've shared with us very candidly was very fascinating. And the industry structure, the business models, I personally learned a lot about how this industry functions. So thank you so much for taking the time out.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure chatting with you guys. And I look forward to our rock climbing session.